for a long time, I've had the impression that InterVarsity was sort of the epitome of C.S. Lewis in a way. That it just, you know, that type of intellectual engagement with the culture exemplified Lewis, and that was what InterVarsity was all about. Does that resonate? Is there something there?
Well, yes and no. At the time of Lewis's first impact on the U.S., it was largely through Clyde Kilby at Wheaton. So at least that Christian college was more of a portal for Lewis into our country. But then it spread from there, and there was actually a significant divide in the country over reaction to Lewis initially. Fundamentalists were offended by the fact that he smoked and drank, and he was an Anglican. The slowly developing evangelical world welcomed him with open arms because he did his Christianity right in the midst of what you could call the hostile secular world, and did it very well. So it came into InterVarsity in interesting ways, and I have here a little anecdote that I think demonstrates how it happened. This is from Keith and Gladys Hunt's History for Christ and the University, and it's about the early days from the 40s on of InterVarsity. This is page 111. About the same time, a student in Colorado named Gene Thomas picked up a His magazine, which was our student magazine that was published until the early 80s, actually, in a dormitory lounge and read it while he waited for his date. He made no claim to being religious. His contact with the church had been spotty and largely negative. He had some interest in God, even prayed at times, and read about the major religions of the world. He found His magazine attractive and relevant and put subscription information in his address book, thinking, I may send for that sometime. Weeks later, he came across the information about His and sent in his subscription. In one of the issues, he read something by C.S. Lewis that prompted him to go to the bookstore and order all the books Lewis had written. He was surprised when that order included books on medieval literature, but it also contained A Case for Christianity, which he found fascinating. Gene subsequently became a believer, was invited onto InterVarsity staff eventually, and became a major force for the growth of InterVarsity in what you might call the Rockies in the West. Was the one who got us to lease and developed Bear Trap Ranch and so forth. So many of the early staff were really struck by what Lewis was doing because, as you say, it was so pertinent to where we lived in InterVarsity. But we were such a tiny minority movement, and staff very seldom got to a campus. I was at the University of Pittsburgh in the mid-50s, and Peter Northrup was one of my staff, and Peter would show up at best once a semester for a couple days and interact with us in our running the InterVarsity, so to speak, and maybe do some evangelism with us on campus. And Peter introduced me to some of C.S. Lewis. I've been an Anglophile all my life, partly because my father's from the north of Ireland, so I had heard about him, but nobody in my religious milieu read him because it was fundamentalist. But Peter encouraged me, and so I think the first thing of Lewis's I read was not the typical one, Screwtape Letters, but one of the smaller books. It might have been the first volume of Mere Christianity, The Case for Christianity. And, of course, I was attracted to it right away and read as much of his stuff as I could find. It didn't come out all that much in my undergraduate years, but by the early 60s, when I was a college prof, it was most of it was in hand and was being published by accessible publishers. So I got into everything then, and of course all the students I influenced very significantly were interested in Lewis because he spoke the university students' language, but saw the relevance of the central story of Christianity. An interesting thing about Lewis is, of course, he is not engaged in science technology at all. And you might think, therefore, that since many of the students and most of the Christian faculty who were active in university in the early days were in the science technology end, that he wouldn't be so relevant. And sometimes people charged him with being anti-science, but in fact that isn't the case. He understood science better than most scientists did, in the sense that he knew where the so-called or supposedly technological end of science ended and the philosophical side began, and most scientists were ignorant of that difference. So he was very helpful to people in the sciences, in spite of that bad reputation, but even more to those who were doing literature. And I can remember some students wrestling with the fact that Lewis obviously disdained anything from T.S. Eliot on in contemporary poetry and much of contemporary literature, even opposed the redoing of the prayer book and so forth. So he was somewhat of a dinosaur, as he says, or a fossil for those who were into contemporary mid to late 20th century literature. But still, his critical approach to things, his ironic way of handling differences, helped a lot of humanities students, as I can recall. And interestingly, liberal Protestants, who were then quite powerful on the campus, every major campus had buildings owned by the mainline denominations and had hired staff on campus. And many of these people were attracted to Lewis too, and it made them a little more sympathetic to Orthodox Christianity. Miracles was something that was much read and discussed, that volume of his, and much debated, and some people cited him as a reason for believing, others thought his arguments were weak, and so forth. So he was very much part of our intellectual world, I would say, in the late 50s on. Interestingly, in the UK, his interaction was different, and I brought another excerpt. This is from Oliver Barclay's History of Evangelicalism in Britain, 1935 to 1995. Oliver Barclay was a PhD scientist at Cambridge who became the second director of Britain's InterVarsity and served that up through the 80s. And I got to know him and work with him and his fellow scientists. We had lots of things to share. And he says that in the 40s, particularly in the war years, British InterVarsity had gotten formally organized in 1928 and was doing well, I think, up through the war years. He mentions C.S. Lewis's radio talks, which became Mere Christianity eventually, which started in 1941. Lewis says he did not have an impressive presence as a public speaker, but these talks made considerable impact. And when they were published, it began to circulate. His writings had a very wide influence, well beyond evangelical circles. And he mentions the problem of pain, which appeared there in 40, the abolition of man, which appeared there in 43. And then he says, Lewis was never an evangelical, but he made traditional orthodoxy both attractive and convincing. Evangelicals used his books enthusiastically, and he gave them and others a fresh confidence that it was possible to proclaim orthodox beliefs as intellectually defensible in the face of attacks from any quarter. So that's the end of the quote. They, both intellectuals and liberals, found him quite engaging. And what happened was that he never could sign InterVarsity's statement of faith because his doctrine of scripture was not quite as explicit as theirs. And yet, he was very, very useful and popular. So they often had mixed feelings about Lewis over there. And I recall that he was not very often invited to speak to university IVF groups.
Did he ever come to the U.S. to speak?
No, he did not. Never crossed the ocean to the U.S. He, in fact, his only out-of-the-U.K. trip was to Greece with his wife shortly before she died. He was, of course, in France during World War I, but other than that, he was between Ireland and the main island all of his life. Lots of shipboard experiences, but none of them for very long voyages. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. But his fame spread over here, and during the later years of the war and on, when Britain was so austere, lots of Americans sent him food packages and so forth. So he would often regale the Magdalen College high table with goodies that his American admirers had sent him, whole hams and things like that. I found that as the years went by, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there were fewer people who were informed about Lewis, had read him, that is, amongst the students. And his more mentally demanding books were not very frequently read at all, I think even by staff. I'm just not sure what kind of use is being made of him these days. But everyone had read the Chronicles of Narnia. In fact, so many have recounted the experience. So many students have told me that they never knew there was a Christian message embedded in that when their parents read the Narnia Chronicles to them. And it was only after they'd become Christians and went back and read them that they found how rich they were. So they perhaps planted a seed in many, many people's hearts that later bloomed into a receptivity to the gospel.
A lot of college students still have found the images and the story of Narnia something that they can identify with. It's not just a children's story. And I know here in Madison, I think elsewhere, sometimes Christian groups would have a newspaper. It was called Aslan's Voice or something like that. So it's not just a children's story.
No, and he, of course, always felt that the best books for children are those that they would read again and again all their life. And I think he's right in that. I still read Wind in the Willows regularly because I think it's a marvelous book. But it was written for little kids, and of course lots of adults love the Pooh stories and so forth. So yes, his books have insights and unique ways of exploring mental situations that are capturing, I think, to a reader at any level of sophistication. So yes, and then people are looking forward to having children and being able to read them to their children for the first time and grandchildren and so forth. So they, I think, will never die. And now that the movie's out, I'll be very interested to see the response. Probably there'll be a huge upsurge in buying the Chronicles. Will they stop reading them after a while because the movies, the Disney images, crowd out the others? I don't know. I would hope that people would see that the movie can never replace the books. But it's an amazing swath of people who are now in their 40s and 50s who had it read to them as children and didn't recognize its Christian message at the time.
And the movie may generate interest in Lewis's other books, too.
I would like to think that, and I know of a few churches that are seizing this opportunity to make the showing of the Chronicles kind of an evangelistic outreach by having parties at which people speak about the books and so forth. So I hope that they do serve as a re-invitation to that kind of evangelism for Christians reaching out.
Have you spoke on Lewis often, campus settings?
Yes, many times in earlier years. Again, I say, as the 80s came along, I'm not sure how much intellectual content would have been a desire of the students. They seem to be wanting people to talk to them about handling pain, you know, married, divorced parents, and a classmate dies, and they don't get the girlfriend they wanted, and those other sources of pain. People talk to them about that. So it may well be that the issues that Lewis wrestled with in his other books don't come on the screen of Christians until they're more mature. So I haven't been asked, but in earlier years, I've done, my notebooks have lots of Lewis talks in one way. And of course, I always stick them in because it just comes to my mind as I've read him so much. And I have, I think, everything he's printed so far and have read almost all of it. Some of the technical medieval studies I couldn't stick with, but I think he's such a felicitous turn of phrase. There's just no one who can express themselves so in such a way as to hook your mind, so he sticks with you a long time.
What books would you recommend for somebody who sees the Narnia Chronicles and is intrigued by Lewis? I mean, Mere Christianity obviously would be one.
Well, that's true, but if you like story, I would highly recommend the three so-called space novels, the trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandra, and That Hideous Strength. If you're a serious reader of novels, Lewis's own favorite of his works was Till We Have Faces, which is a retelling of that ancient Cupid and Psyche myth. And it's a chance for Lewis to communicate what really led him to the Lord in the first place, when Tolkien and others convinced him that Christianity was a myth, but it happened to be the true myth. He was able to put both sides of his life together, so to speak, and found Christ very attractive, which he hadn't up until that time. So that retelling of the myth, if you are a reader of novels, can really get you thinking about contemporary life, about human values, about truth. So if you like that kind of fiction, I think those are excellent. In terms of challenging cultural values in favor of Christian values, one that is very seldom read, but the current editions have a lot of explanatory footnotes, is The Pilgrim's Regress, which is sort of Lewis's autobiography in literary form. And people have charged it with being cruel because he makes fun of contemporary arts, literary arts in particular, of his time, in quite savage ways. And some of the great icons of 20th century poetry, for instance, are not too subtly lampooned by him in that book. But he talks about, for instance, the traveler in that world finds that the world is divided by a deep chasm. North, south, wherever you go, there's this deep chasm which appears to be uncrossable. And it happened when a young farmer and his wife were visited by the landlord, in which time he planted some trees for them and told them to enjoy them all, but the one particular tree they weren't to eat, and the farmer's wife and the farmer ate that, and immediately a crack occurred all the way around the world. And one part of the world you simply couldn't get to. And Lewis found out, he tried every way he could to get there, and he found out there was only one way, and it's a figure in the book called Mother Kirk, K-R-K, which is the church. Mm. And she tells him, there's this deep divide filled with water, he wants to cross it. She tells him, you can't jump in feet first. You have to go in head first and go down as deep as you can, or you won't come up on the other side. Meaning, you have to give yourself totally without any control to God in order to get to his land. So that story is a gripping evangelistic tale for those who can read it well, particularly those interested in early 20th century literature. And if you're upset by contemporary intellectual culture, you should read The Abolition of Man, because he points out why high school and university education since probably the 40s has been, in his judgment, more destructive than constructive of the human being. And it's all about men without chests. He says that contemporary civilization, and it is so true, has highly developed mental processes and very well used sensory processes, but no way of connecting them. There are no values, no ethics, no morals, no deep heaven-sent insights that connect the two. And so when you have just brains and guts running a world, it's bound to be a disaster, and that's what we've become. I think it's one of his finest books, but of course, if you're a professional educator, you could be very insulted by it.
What about the problem of pain? You mentioned that issue a few minutes ago.
Well, you know, he wrote it before he met Joy Davidman, and just in the early days of experience with her. And if you've seen the Joss Ackland Shadowlands or the American one, they make a big play out of how he used a phrase from that book in his sermon at Great St. Mary's about pain. But I think that's a very good insight. He did suffer pain. He lost his mother when he was 9 years old. His father never understood either Lewis or his brother, and they were largely estranged from him as they grew up. And he'd had other broken relations, and so he knew that kind of pain. It was written before his own cancer and other serious medical problems began. But I think it's a very good insight to how to deal with pain and how to believe in God in spite of pain and suffering. One thing I think people forget is he himself had read almost everything in Western literature up to the 20s at least. And he knew medieval and ancient literature backwards and forwards, again, European literature. So he brought the resources of the ancient and medieval world to bear on modern problems in ways hardly anyone else could. And people regard him as a wise man, and he would say, that's because I read all the ancient wise men and pass on their stories. So the problem of pain is very good. The miracles one has some questionable arguments in it. Because he didn't understand, and no one talked about what science really was in those days, because he bought into a fairly educated concept of science, he thought that miracles were interventions by God. And I think many of us, believing scientists today, would say, no, Christ upholds the creation constantly and at every instant. And so what we regard as the laws of science are simply the patterns that Jesus uses to run things. But occasionally he interrupts those patterns for his own purposes, and those are what we call miracles. So they're not interventions. They're simply a change of pattern for some particular reason that God has in mind. Given that older definition of miracle, I think he does a stout defense of it, but it didn't stand careful scrutiny. It's the one intellectual argument he felt bested by at Oxford in the old days when they had the Socratic Club. Elizabeth Anscombe, a very powerful positivist analytical philosopher and a Wittgenstein student, got the best of him, and he actually was quite thankful for her arguments because it showed his weren't that good, but he never quite recovered his energy in that direction. So miracles is flawed, but it also raises a lot of important points. So it's useful. I think a better definition of miracle is needed.
What did C.S. Lewis do for university then, looking back from this perspective decades later?
I think it would turn out that a good many of our staff, I would say at least up through the 70s, were either brought to the Lord after reading Lewis and being convinced that you could love God with your mind as well as your feelings, and a good many students were nourished on Lewis. I remember being at a conference at which Peter Hale was a speaker. Peter was one of the four IVF Britain graduates who were sent over to help launch InterVarsity in the early 40s. Peter was speaking at this conference, and when I blabbed on about how I liked Lewis, he was astonished that a scientist could love Lewis, but he basically used Lewis-type arguments, occasionally quoting him, for this whole weekend conference for students, and it was revelatory for them. Although it was kind of second nature to him, it was brand new to many of them. So I would say Lewis's work, this intellectually rigorous and honest grappling with the Christian story as a whole person, not just a brain, was a gateway for the conversion of many in InterVarsity, but also for the nurturing as university people of many early InterVarsity people. We don't often talk about it, but I imagine if you surveyed a number of our senior staff who are still around, they would say that Lewis underneath was extremely important for our work.